Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you, Dimitri, for your kind words. And I obviously reiterate the gratitude we have to all those partners in making this event possible. So this second thought, this second talk is called Thinking Geologically. Being geologically human is the name of a question. What could it mean to understand ourselves as the product of historical and evolutionary and geological processes? Last time, I discussed this question in the light of the various shocks that we humans have received to our self-understanding, culminating in the current ongoing displacement of our sense of sovereignty, even as we've entered the Anthropocene. This is kind of strange, because it seems that our loss of sovereignty is coinciding with the recognition of our geological scale impact on the planet. I began, too, to deal with our affective response to this situation, which supplements traditional wonder and curiosity and delight, the kind of normal cosmic sentiments, with a more pervasive anxiety, to which I tried to give a positive spin. Such a mood is connected in complex ways to questions of agency and responsibility, which I'm going to focus on in my next last talk on Friday. Today I want to take up the question of how we situate ourselves in time, in deep time, in history. I'm following up Derrida's discussion of how we inherit the past in his book Spectres of Marx. A lot hangs, as we've seen, on who we take ourselves to be. But I'm not alone in thinking that how we move forward into the future is strongly dependent on how we take up the past, and in that respect also how deep we go in thinking about what that past might be. Thinking geologically takes this question to the limit. So to pursue this question of inheriting the past, I turn once again to Nietzsche. In 1874, he wrote an extraordinary essay, The Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life. It was provoked by his sense, perhaps a prevailing sense, that a surfeit of historical knowledge could crush the human spirit. Its failures, the failures of our past, would weigh upon us like the coffins returned from the war zone. If things looked bad then, how much worse are they now? Continued enthusiasm for life, he thought, depends on a certain capacity for active forgetting. And yet we can and we must learn from history in various ways. Nietzsche distinguishes the monumental, the antiquarian, and the critical. Each, he thinks, is essential, but when taken separately, each can get out of control and become a weed. This is what he wrote. Every man and every nation requires, in accordance with its goals, Nietzsche's discussion here is a prime example of how to nuance the relation between reason and passion, critique and the burden of the past. In his own words, he writes, and this is fascinating formulation, he says, since we are the outcome of earlier generations, we're also the outcome of their aberration, their passions and errors, and indeed of their crimes. It's not possible to free oneself from this chain. If we condemn these aberrations and regard ourselves as free of them, this doesn't alter the fact that we originate in them. The best we can do, says Nietzsche, is to confront our inherited and hereditary nature with our knowledge of it. And here's the critical moment. And through a stern discipline, combat our inborn heritage and implant in ourselves a new habit, a new instinct, a second nature, so that our first nature withers away. So we could, again, we could speak of here of re-educating our passions. He writes, what happens all too often is that we know the good, but we do not do it. And this is the point at which I revert to that quote that I started too quickly. Every man and every nation requires, in accordance with its goals, energies, and needs, a certain kind of knowledge of the past, which has at all times been desired only in the service of the future and the present, and not for the weakening of the present or for depriving a vigorous future of its roots. This is what he thinks is needed for what he calls the ends of life. Great deeds often require great forgetting. Now, the word life, when Nietzsche uses it, is deployed up and down the scale from the individual level, the individual life, through a nation to an age, with the emphasis typically on the nation. Throughout the essay, he describes the positive and negative aspects of each of these three ways of taking history seriously, showing how each can become kind of mental kudzu when unchecked. His deep sense is that becoming, as he puts it, mustn't be allowed to be ruled by being. While it can be salutary to learn from the errors of the past we revere was often made by those lacking historical knowledge for whom ignorance was bliss. Nietzsche's talking, of course, here about human history, in the sense of the history of a nation culture, especially late 19th century Germany. And one couldn't imagine a more poignant, relevant circumstance for these issues and tensions to be played out than post-Holocaust Germany a few decades later. But how elastic is this we? Remember the title of this essay? The uses and disadvantages of history for life, and we're talking about what we should be doing. Who is this we? How elastic is it? Can we transpose the scope of these considerations from national history to human history in the broader sense, including the very emergence of the human? Could we take history back into the geological, before life itself? And could we raise these issues as a species rather than as a nation? Moreover, when Nietzsche in the title and within the essay speaks of life, for life, remember, could we take him at his word, life? Or must we understand him just to mean human life? When he speaks of confronting our hereditary nature with our knowledge of it, as he puts it, so as to grow a second nature, better instincts, that calls out for at least a broadening to the level of the species, it would be a contribution, for example, to the Freud-Einstein correspondence about war in 1932. And whatever Nietzsche might have meant by this or that, how might we construe these remarks? In other words, maybe we could rework what he thought he was talking about and say, well, let's take you seriously, even more seriously than you took yourself, talking about life. Might they not equally apply to our deeper history? Who are we, anyway? What if that were the issue? In case we were to think we were betraying Nietzsche, there's reason to think that Nietzsche would not protest too much to this broadening of scope. First of all, Nietzsche's already talking supra-historically, as if looking in on history from the outside. This would suggest that his remarks could be broadened because we are no less inside and outside our species' history. Secondly, when you look at The Genealogy of Morals, another famous book of his, it's clear that Nietzsche has no hesitation in transcending nationality into a speculative history of Western man. And thirdly, from his early essay on truth, it's clear he has no privileged place allotted for the human. The gnat, little buzzing gnat, too thinks it's the center of the universe, says Nietzsche. And I might add, he is himself echoing Kant's comparison of man with a self-important louse in the Universal Natural History essay. Fourthly, Nietzsche is a materialist, or at least the inspiration for many new materialists. He has a huge suspicion of every move to transcendence. Instead, he writes, be true to the earth. And lastly, he's equally interested in post-human possibilities, as when he describes man as a bridge between ape and overman. what would new instincts and new habits look like? So, adding his own essay to the compost heap of history, how might we begin to translate his essay from the historical to the geological? Consider the first, the monumental approach. Here the idea is that history can provide examples of human achievement, potentially inspiring. If we extract from this the idea of the exemplary and being able to imagine on the grand scale, the geological offers many challenging models. A year before 9/11, the Project for the New American Century group said that we would need a new Pearl Harbor for public attitudes to be receptive enough to the kinds of changes they thought were necessary for America. Monumental history would look to events in the past that could in various different ways inspire geological scale transformation. These would be both positive and negative, human and natural. In human events, the social transformations that led to the French Revolution, the abolition of slavery, the formation of the United Nations, the provision in some countries of universal health care, putting a man on the moon, these we would perhaps set off against the Holocaust, Hiroshima, Guantanamo, and the Rwanda genocide. Nature's monumental events here are largely negative. The Lisbon and San Francisco earthquakes, Hurricane Katrina, the last ice age, earlier mass species extinctions, offset perhaps by the Big Bang itself as an event so momentous that the word positive hardly seems appropriate. Oh yes, that was a good thing, that Big Bang. Ruminating on these events reminds us of the possibility of radical social transformation, unprecedented technological achievements, the unspeakable evil men can do, our ability to mobilize in the face of natural disaster, and our frequent unpreparedness, and the overwhelming power of nature. In this sense, the monumental can be sobering as well as inspiring. Drawing appropriate conclusions from these events and achievements undoubtedly calls for judgment, and hence partnership with a critical approach to history. The second of these three approaches, the antiquarian, is dedicated to preserving values from the past. And here I'd focus broadly on what we may still call Enlightenment values, values that led to the promotion of universal suffrage, education, healthcare, human rights, and so on. When even Derrida will at times champion justice, cosmopolitanism, and a democracy to come, it's as clear as day that Enlightenment values, as indeed Habermas too affirms, can only be improved on by further critique, more enlightenment, maybe enlightenment about the limits of enlightenment. How would the preservation and extension of enlightenment values happen geologically? There are two obvious dimensions in which this must occur. A paradigm-shifting inclusion of the interests of non-humans and of future humans and non-human generations. This would begin to realize a more literal understanding of the scope of life in the title of Nietzsche's essay. But for this, we need to move to the third approach to history, the critical. Now, recall Nietzsche again. We mustn't pretend the past is not full of crimes. The best we can do is to confront our inherited and hereditary nature with our knowledge of it, and through a new stern discipline, combat our inborn heritage and implant in ourselves a new habit, a new instinct. With these words, Nietzsche encourages quite an agenda for the critical approach to history, and one with expansive implications. Now, pursuing all the details here would take a number of other papers, and much of what needs to be said would be just assembling reminders of what we already know. But a quick take on what this involves would be this. The introduction of the idea of the Anthropocene, we saw last time, is a recognition of the geological scale impact of human beings, or at least the latest variant of the human, Homo sapiens, on the planet. The key dimensions of this impact are two. First, the dramatic displacement and extinction of countless non-human species, and an equally dramatic increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, leading to global warming with potentially catastrophic and irreversible consequences. So in Nietzsche's words, to confront our inherited and hereditary nature with our knowledge of it requires us to scrutinize this very idea of an inherited nature and point to the colonization of biological givens, like our desire for security and for pleasure and for power, and culturally acquired add-ons, like new commodified desires. All this colonization and these acquisitions, all in the interest of fossil fuel companies and the military-industrial complex, driven and enabled by an economic system unsustainably predicated on the externalizing of its environmental costs to finite natural sinks like the atmosphere and the oceans. It's not clear that we can entirely separate ourselves, our imagination, our practices, our bodies, our desires, our values, and our reflective powers from these newly minted consumer subjects that we are. Geological angst keeps us awake at night or rocks us sounded to sleep, while critical history plots what Nietzsche calls new habits, new instincts. What can we critically learn from an expanded geological sense of history? We can perhaps dream of moving on from the past, letting the dead bury the dead, and for good reason. For it does, history does impose a heavy weight. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's recent book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, paints an appalling story of the genocidal foundations of the United States, making the fact that Columbus Day is a national holiday into an obscenity. I'm writing, as I speak, I was writing then, on a large farm in Tennessee that may well have been appropriated from the Cherokee. The Trail of Tears, often deadly forced march of Native Americans to Oklahoma, came by here. That I know. This is a past from which I and we are still profiting. As Australians, you yourselves bear a troubling legacy. The modern Aboriginal peoples who you found living here are the descendants of migrants from Africa. Many distinct Aboriginal peoples who had lived sustainably on the continent for millennia. As a Brit, of course, I am no less burdened, not least by colonialism. We are inextricably entangled with the past. It's hard not to feel guilt, and yet guilt itself can be, but need not be, unproductive penance. As Beckett would write, we can't go on. We must go on. We need to move on, saying, never again. More to the point, while we mustn't forget the specifics, we must not let that never again be fixated on those specifics. The deep never again has to do with our human propensity to numbing violence, which continues today, and with sheer folly. Is it too much to hope that the lessons we need to have learned from our more than troubled past might be transferred to our current predicament? The one thing we can learn is that the categories by which we partition the difference between the human and the natural may no longer be reliable. Global warming is, which, you know, also known as climate disaster or climate disruption, is an anthropogenic natural event of a geological order. Both natural and human events are at times reversible and irreversible, but we're used to the idea of being able to deal with them, recover from them, repair the damage, however dreadful that sounds in the case, say, of genocide. Life goes on, at least for others, however dreadfully scarred. The reason may be that deep background conditions have not much changed. Even the horrors of war and famine can get absorbed into the historically familiar. But climate change may well not be like that. If it changes background conditions that substantially affect the space of the possible, say the course of evolution, the habitability of large parts of the planet, the services of pollinating insects, just to name a few, then we will learn the wrong lesson from history if we take even the epoch-making monumental historical models, historical events, as our models. The accelerating burning of fossil fuels, the stored energy of millions of years of sunshine in a few short centuries, is a dramatic, unrepeatable, and irreversible event, and as geological as they come. In response, now that the horse has escaped from the stable, we're promoting adaptation over prevention. For if we take the likely meteor impact that set off the last gray species extinction as our model, we have no human response to learn from. The best examples we can find would probably be mass mobilization in Europe in the Second World War, in which all material and human resources were mobilized towards the war effort. The scope and seriousness of the response is what justifies references to the war on drugs, or the war on poverty, or the war on terror. But these are pale imitations of the original. If in the last case there's some semblance of mobilizing all available resources, as in like the war on terror, the lesson is profoundly unsettling. It licensed the creation of a security state with accompanying attacks on personal freedom. These metaphorical wars do offer something new, which is profoundly important for our geological reality. They introduce the idea of a mortal struggle without an identifiable enemy, or a struggle which is as much a struggle with the webs in which we have entangled ourselves as it is with something truly external, what Derrida calls the autoimmune. Again, the lesson is not obviously learned. For whatever reason, the war on terror turned into an alibi for pursuing existing military objectives in Iraq, or a hunt for specific terrorists in the case of bin Laden, which is no way to drain the swamp, which is what was just that it was said we were going to go and drain the swamp, which would attack conditions that generate the problem and not the symptoms. I mean, that would make some sense, draining the swamp. We didn't do that. In principle, such a critical approach to monumental history could serve us extremely well when thinking geologically. You would think that the kind of disaster preparedness inaugurated, for example, by the Katrina fiasco, would be helpful. But again, previous disasters may teach the wrong lesson. The simple thought here is that most disaster planning assumes a local problem that can be addressed by rushing supplies and people from another safe, unaffected area. Think of, you know, sending tents to medical help to Bengal, which is happening today and yesterday. I mean, this is wonderful. There are places that are not Bengal, that are not affected, from which we can send hospital equipment and medical supplies and tents. But cascading global crises might not be able to be addressed like this. There may be no other place from which we can send supplies. It's an analog to the crisis in the idea of away that arises when places where we throw things away are full. The pieces can no longer just be moved around the board. Jared Diamond's book Collapse is an interesting candidate for the critical approach, again, with an ambivalent lesson. His central proposition is that wherever these globally disparate societies failed, the chief cause was anthropogenic ecological devastation, especially deforestation, imposed on ecosystems of limited resources. He references the Anasazi, the Maya, Greenland, Rwanda, and his own state of Montana, among others. The lesson these cases teach us is that these collapses were self-inflicted and could have been avoided if the civilizations in question had kept in touch with their own ecological conditions of possibility. They made bad choices. The deeply shocking thought is that some such fate might befall not a particular local culture, but the globally unified culture of the human. For that, there is no precedent. But how it could happen could hardly be clearer. And we can respond with resignation or with determination that it not happen to us, armed with the thought that it still could. Climate change can take on a genuinely apocalyptic character, depending how far into the future we peer and how much we focus on worst-case scenarios. The IPCC offers a scary range of options in terms of worst-case scenarios. But as much as we might think it ought to be studied sociologically, if we think about all these worst-case scenarios, you might think that it ought to be studied sociologically rather than scientifically. There's a long history, you know, of failed, widely shared doomsday fears, from that of nuclear Armageddon, widely feared in the 60s, I remember that, to the Y2K or millennium bug as the year 2000 dawned, which we survived, not to mention smaller groups of believers like the Branch Davidians or those who followed the Mayan calendar, which predicted the end of the world on my birthday in 2012, or indeed the crew of Monty Python. Will this wind be so mighty as to lay low the mountains of the earth? No, it will not be so mighty. Is not public hysteria a well-documented phenomenon? Would not a critical response to history make us pause before taking this latest fad seriously? Well, there are two obvious responses to this. First, millenarian cults have rarely had the backing of 97% of climate scientists, who, without all predicting total disaster, attest to the fact that this is happening. And second, it's worth remembering the story of the boy who cried wolf. After many false alarms, the villagers did not believe him when the wolf actually came. A few false dawns do not rule out real dawns. There's another problem that only a critical approach can bring out. The focus on monumental history, in particular, largely addresses dramatic events worthy of a name. What we face in the emergence of the Anthropocene, or the sixth extinction, is not an event of the same order, not so visible, but rather a drawn-out process. I'm reminded of the frog in water. You've probably heard this image before. If you apparently, well, this is not true, but apparently it is said that if you put a frog in water and heat it up slowly, not the frog, the water, it will simply get boiled alive because there's no increment. The water just gets slowly, very, very, very slowly warmer. And there's no point at which the frog sort of says, there's something wrong here. It just gets, and finally gets boiled alive, never jumps out. A critical approach would have us look at the shape and direction of processes, not just at history's fireworks. As has often been said, if we wait for a new Pearl Harbor, an electrifying event, it will be too late. In terms of initiating dramatic changes in consumer lifestyles, such events, or their dramatic equivalent, may seem to be needed because people need to be motivated to change before they actually have to. And it may well raise what we might call a logical problem. What if it involves new values And what if changing, as it were, would involve acquiring new values? How can we want values that only make sense in a new paradigm when you're still in the old paradigm? This is the deep problem behind Nietzsche talking about new habits and new instincts. Can we enter into such new arrangements voluntarily or only under duress, under the pressure of circumstances? Here again is a question of passion. Serving what passion could reason instruct us of the need for new passions? Well, Hobbes would probably say fear. One specific way in which the critical dimension to history would be important is in welcoming a wider sense of life, one that included non-humans, and indeed non-mammals, as equal stakeholders on planet Earth. I'm not going to offer arguments here for such an extension, but these arguments largely rest on the common capacity for suffering or for having a life in some way worth living. It's important also to bring out the radical interdependence of the many life forms and the folly of cherry-picking the friendly furry mammals for special treatment. Now, these arguments, of course, are not without assumptions that can be questioned. And it may well be that some sort of affective resonance, often in short supply, may be necessary for these arguments to actually carry in practice. But if truth be told, this is no less the case for the various other forms of ethical extensionism that push obligation beyond family and friends and people of the same sex, color, or ethnic identity. Human history gives us countless examples of the progressive inclusion within ethical protection of both animals and humans, especially on racial and gender grounds. Animals and ecosystems are arguably next in line for the full treatment. How radical a shift would it be for each of us to think of ourselves primarily as living beings, not sentimentally, but simply treating other beings, other creatures, directly and indirectly with respect. This thought's only reinforced when, as we mentioned last time, we consider the microbiome project revealing that we're each already communities of creatures. The expansion of the we into life itself is the conceit behind my reworking of Nietzsche's essay. And history, as they say, may be against us here, as more and more children suffer from nature deficit disorder and do not have the visceral attunement or intuitions to easily engage with the natural world, let alone identify with it. The same applies to future generations, stakeholders who do not yet exist, with real interests but no voice. I mean here both human future generations and those entire species that may be wiped out before we get there. To discount the interests of species we will have wiped out really is to legitimate the logic of genocide. After all, if you wipe out people, they have no voice. It's perhaps about time, however, to raise Nietzsche's central concern. Doesn't such a critical geological consciousness impose an intolerable and incapacitating burden on us? Don't we need to forget much of this, however true, in order to flourish? I will come to this. What I last time called geological angst is not a choice, but a condition that we find ourselves in. We can, as I've said, convert it into fear to construct an object and make practical action possible, or in some other way resolve it. I'm instead recommending creative ways of exercising what I would call a certain negative capability. That's an ability to tolerate uncertainty, keeping the angst alive. As I see it, a critical consciousness, drawing on the monumental and antiquarian approaches to history that we talked about, does just that. It doesn't prescribe remedies as such, but rather, in Heidegger's language, it prepares the way. It points in the right direction. As I see it, a little bit of a switch sideways here, it wouldn't betray Nietzsche's position to suggest that, concerned as we are with deep geological time, such a critical consciousness needs to absorb a certain temporal phronesis, or facility with thinking about time and all its multi-stranded complexity. I was reading a book by Tamsin Lorraine the other day, and she writes about, and I quote, attuning ourselves to the multiple durations of our lives in ways that allow us to skillfully unfold the creative possibilities of the multiple assemblages of which we form a part, rather than fixate on our representations of life. I would tweak this a little by adding that the multiple durations of our lives are now stretched out against the sky, extended, exploded onto a geological frame, and that the meaning of hour and life is fundamentally in question. In thinking about these multiple durations, in thinking geologically about our situation, riding the climate change tiger of the Anthropocene, it's worth articulating some of the concrete shapes of time with which we need to be able to work. I'll just go through a few of these. First of all, irreversibility. There are interesting ways in which we can change the past. For example, by marrying the woman you met on the bus, which turns that meeting on the bus into the first time we met, by constituting a continuing us. Or finally, you know, winning the lottery after decades of trying to win the lottery completely uselessly until you win. And then new narrative makes sense of the old actions. And we often take it for granted that, as we said, events are reversible. We mend things we break. We apologize for bad behavior. We repay debts and loans. But climate change is, for all intents and purposes, irreversible. And species loss to extinction is forever. And it's not clear we've actually grasped this. Second of these sort of temporal dimensions or aspects, fatal delay. Sometimes, as they say, time is of the essence. If the train has left the station, you missed it. Preventing catastrophic climate change means acting before we have absolute proof that we need to. Thirdly, structural inertia. We find ourselves saddled with a toxic economic system that would have to change before the change we need can happen. It's hard to see how to change the direction of this, actually, yes, oil tanker, this tanker. Fourthly, uneven development. Arguably, there's a mismatch between our inherited instincts, our current technological capacities, and the social and political institutions needed to manage the consequences of deploying them. Fifthly, tipping points. We act as if change was linear when it's often best described by catastrophe theory. At a tipping point, dramatic nonlinear events occur. We go to war. We snap in anger. The water overflows the glass. Tipping points are often examples of a broader shape that we could call the open future, a recognition that induction may no longer help us, that there's a genuine uncertainty about what may happen. Sixthly, time unimaginable. I used to live inside of Warwick Castle in England, built in 1068. I can just about understand the American Civil War happening in 1865. The age of my farm is about 100 years. My puppy is about 4 months old. All these are roughly imaginable times. But then I'm told the age of the universe is 4.5 billion years, and something gives. The other day I thought I had a handle on it, actually, when I was told that the coral fossil, I think I mentioned this last time, still traced on my limestone rocks, is some 450 million years old. I thought, well, the universe is just 10 of those, and I can count them on my hands. But I was kidding myself in supposing that I could tune into the original 450 million I mean, you know, I got to 350 million, they just stopped. It's at this point that I have some sympathy with Bishop Usher, who proclaimed the universe to be 6,000 years old, with God carefully depositing fossils for our amusement. Seriously, it almost seems manageable. But as much as I cannot imaginatively grasp, even indirectly, such a time period, I can, with a touch of the sublime, realize that I can't grasp it. At the other end of the spectrum, we might repeat the reference to messianic time from our previous list, anticipating, so to speak, the impossible, the unimaginable, an event for which we have no concept. Seventhly, multiple strands. We're participants in and witnesses to multiple processes, each of which have their own time horizons and which spawn their own narratives, some overlapping, others seemingly independent. There's my day, my life, my historical consciousness, not to mention the gentrification of my neighborhood, the decay of the public sector, the evolution of mammals, the birth of galaxies, it goes on. Scale and material qualities separate and entangle these different times. And lastly, from start to finish, we're now in a position to grasp in a geobiological perspective both the story of our own origin as humans and quite possibly of our own demise. If not as a biological species, at least as a dream or an imaginary or a promise. This temporal framing of the human project is almost unprecedented. It echoes the Foucault quote that we began with last time about man being like a face about to be erased at the edge of the sea. These sort of temporal dimensions I've just talked about are each little shapes, molecules, templates, apps of time. Even when they can't be detected ahead of time, we arm ourselves better when we can recognize their likely or possible applicability. I'm suggesting that dealing with geological time, responding to it, requires in part the articulation and development of a range of time heuristics, both general and specific. And I don't think Nietzsche would object. But I don't want to straightforwardly endorse everything he says. Take, for example, forgetting. I want to refresh and reimagine the significance Nietzsche gives to forgetting. This shouldn't be too difficult. Plato associates philosophy with remembering, with anamnesis. Heidegger talks about, you know, trying to combat the forgetfulness of being. Forgetting, in the usual sense, is the source of much folly. So isn't there a willful perversity in Nietzsche's championing of forgetting? Surely it's not without reason that we say of events in our barbarous past, never forget. And Santayana wrote, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. With only a little license, let me suggest some ways, finally, in which we too can support a certain positive forgetting. Pessimism about the future often rests on the anticipation of tipping points that will bring accelerated change and spell disaster. But non-linearity can also be our friend. Public opinion is equally subject to tipping points. And if we're going to take new habits and new passions seriously, we need to forget the old ones, even if that forgetting involves a lot of working through. There are clearly issues to do with forgetting when it comes to the historic carbon privilege, polluting and profiting, enjoyed by rich nations. And you know, it may be that the wealthy West needs to just forget those good old days. And then there's another form of forgetting, debt forgiveness, to enable developing countries to actually start investing in other forms of energy. It would be hard to come down against the affirmation of life and valuing what's life-affirming. It will, however, be rightly said that the devil is in the details. Is it an affirmation of life for me to smush the mosquito drilling for blood on my neck? Whose life? Don't we need to get specific about life? Do we really have any idea what we mean by life affirmation, or by doing history in the service of life? In crude ways, we do. Biodiversity, good. Monoculture, bad. Flourishing, good. Being poisoned by toxic waste, bad. A vibrant, healthy ecosystem, good. Extinction, bad. Of course, it's true that most of these terms are contested. And if we said, Earth with humans, good. Earth without humans, bad. No, slow down. You never know. My bet is that a critical inheritance of our deep history is a good thing. precisely because it doesn't just answer these questions, it keeps them alive. As for forgetting, it's clearly a matter of management, of judgment, even for Nietzsche. We need to be able to forget, he says, but at times, and I quote, we may need a temporary suspension of this forgetfulness when we recall how unjust the existence of anything, a privilege, a caste, a dynasty, for example, is, and how greatly this thing deserves to perish. Well, as you will have gathered, Nietzsche is something of a touchstone in these talks. In my last lecture on Friday, I want to address the question of our responsibility in the face of anthropogenic climate change, and in ways that might surprise even Nietzsche. What is to be done? And after the subject as agent has been deconstructed, by whom is it to be done? Thank you.